The last time we met, a couple of weeks ago, we were looking at the statement in verse 4 and 5 that we are not in the darkness, or in darkness actually without the definite article. And the outcome of that is that the day of the Lord can't come upon us like a thief, because it's only going to come upon people in darkness like a thief. But we realize from our study that the idea is not that we will see it coming so that it won't overtake us. That's not the idea, because he's already told us you don't have any need for anybody to write to you, because this day is going to come like a thief, and that means you're not going to know. So the idea that it's not going to come upon us doesn't mean that we're going to know when it's coming and therefore we'll be ready or whatever. The idea is we don't belong in a sphere where the day of the Lord is going to be applied, and that is the darkness, the night. And the reason, he says in verse 5, is because you're sons of light and sons of the day. We're not of the night. We're not of the darkness, and therefore what's going to happen in the darkness is not going to affect us. We're not going to be here. So we're going to see that more clearly as we move on through the rest of the paragraph. It goes down through verse 10 or 11. I've got it at 10, but anyway. The point being, Paul is developing this concept of an answer to an unrecorded but anticipated question. That is, if the rapture in chapter 4 is going to happen, then the obvious question is when. And basically he says, you're not going to know the when. The when's not for us to know. The times and the seasons are not for us to know. And the fact that the rapture is tied to the day of the Lord in terms of we're not going to know that kind of thing is because he used the plural times and seasons. You're not going to know the times and the seasons. Well, each time is a period of progressive development that is connected to something that was declared that would happen, and then over time it happens. And the season is the time at the end of that, the period at the end of that, when it actually comes to fruition. That's the season of the fruit. That's when it's ripe. So the times and the seasons, every time has a season at the end of it. But because it's plural, he's almost like he's presenting a kind of a like a multi-strand cable where there are multiple things that are times, and each of those have a season, so there are multiple seasons. But because it's all coming together at this thing that the Bible calls the day of the Lord, that's the end event. Those things are all going to come together at the end. And so the question of when the rapture is going to occur has to be inferred. It's not the same thing as the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is coming like a thief for destructive purposes, according to verse 3. It's going to be disaster, and the rapture is not a disaster. So in verses 4 and 5, which we looked at last time, the whole issue there is it's not going to catch you like a thief. It's not going to bring this disaster upon you like it is everybody that's saying peace and safety. And the most obvious answer to the question, well, why not, is because you're not going to be here. That's chapter 4. You're going to be raptured. You're going to be caught up together with the Lord. And therefore, being a son of light, a son of the day, you're not going to be here for the night period of that day of the Lord event or series of events. This evening, we're going to look at verse 6, which in my translation reads like this. So then, let's not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. So we're going to be looking at what he's trying to get across there. The issue of verse 6, the so then, is actually a translation of a doubled up conjunction where you have a transition that is typically, well, because there's two of them, one on the heels of the other, one of them technically isn't necessary. I mean, you're transitioning to a therefore or a then or whatever, but each of the conjunctions has their own little kind of nuance of meaning, and when we see what that is, we'll see why he put them together in verse 6. The two conjunctions are used in the New Testament individually, and characteristically, what they bring to the table is a conclusion based on the preceding information. So we would typically translate that kind of like therefore. And actually, the most widely used of the two is the ones translated then, and that's typically therefore. And it's the idea that, okay, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, therefore, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. In other words, this is the foundation, and therefore this is the outcome or the conclusion or whatever. Both of them have that idea, that there's something here that's true, and then there's a conclusion that should be drawn from this truth. But they each bring something a little bit different to the table. The first one that's translated in the New American Standard, so, is kind of interesting because the Logos Bible program actually says it's an untranslatable interrogative and it implies anxiety or impatience. Which, it's not untranslated. I don't know why they say that, and I'm not sure that you can imply anxiety or impatience in the case either. So I didn't stick with them very long. There may be, I mean, they may have said that it implies anxiety or impatience, because there may be an undercurrent of a kind of animosity in the author's mind toward false conclusions. And therefore, he's drawing out the conclusion that ought to be drawn and doesn't have much patience with any other conclusion. That may be why they said, I don't really know. But there is that possibility. Because if you're going to lay down a doctrinal foundation and then say, now the outcome of that ought to be this, well, then obviously you're going to be opposed to anybody that takes that doctrine and then turns the outcome into something that's not that. So that may explain why they say that it implies impatience or anxiety, why they say it's untranslatable. I don't know, because it's translated many, many times in the New Testament. But A.T. Robertson, who in his day was considered to be probably one of the top Greek grammarians in his generation, grammar of the New Testament's this thick. It's a extremely detailed. And I follow his grammar a great deal because he agrees with me. So, I mean, you know, when I read something, I say, wow, yeah. You know, I say, okay, this guy knows what he's talking about. So there's just a lot of ego on my part there. But nonetheless, in his grammar, he does characterize this first conjunction, so, translated so, he says that the conclusion that's being drawn when you use this particular word is a conclusion that's eminently suitable. It's kind of like, okay, you've said this, and then you want to draw a conclusion, and the conclusion fits this, kind of like a hand in a glove, or like two gears that mesh. This is the way it works. So this idea of an imminent suitability is involved. So when Paul puts that in here, so let's not sleep, he's saying that's an imminently suitable conclusion to the fact that you're not of the night. Because he's going to say in verse 7, those who sleep do their sleeping at night. If you're not of the night, sorry, you don't get to sleep anymore. Which is kind of an interesting figure. But nonetheless, when we take Robertson's suggestion that there is this idea of suitability that's tied, then we can see that, okay, this is true. Therefore, we ought to be involved in this way of looking at things. And it's particularly suited. It fits. And I think the point is that Paul wrote this first conjunction to indicate that he saw a very strong link between his fact of our status, you are sons of light, sons of the day, or sons of day. He said that of the Thessalonians without regard to their spiritual levels of maturity. Doesn't matter if you're just a brand new child of God or a fully developed saint. He just says, you're all this. So that's a declaration of status. That's what you are. And given the fact that Paul very strongly argues that your confidence in what God declares to be true about you is the basis for the decisions you make and the actions you take. So if this is what you are, then this is what you ought to do. I mean, if you're a rattlesnake, then you should bite things with your fangs. You know, if you're, and you can go with that on any level. Whatever it is that you are kind of determines then what you're going to do. So his fact is that the day of the Lord will not overtake believers because they are sons of light and sons of day, and they're not of night nor of darkness. So his declaration is the day of the Lord doesn't apply to you as a believer. These destructive things that are going to come suddenly like birth pangs on a woman with no escape, these things are not going to apply to you as a believer. And his fitting conclusion then is that there are certain behaviors that ought to be in place because they alone fit that fact. And the behavior is, there's actually three things that he tells us in verse 6 that should be suitable to the fact that we're children, sons of light and sons of day. One of them is, must don't sleep. The other is, let's stay awake. And the third one is, let's be sober. And we'll see just how well that fits together in just a minute. But the second conjunction, the then, this is the one that's used all over the New Testament. It's widely, widely used. It's typically a therefore concept. Because this is true, therefore do this. And I really believe that Paul put them together because, well, he does it 12 times in the New Testament. He puts them together. And in every case, unless I missed something, what he's saying is, look, there isn't any other conclusion you can draw but this. It's eminently suitable, and it's the therefore that comes after this fact. And so he really wants us to zero in on who we are in relation to the day of the Lord. We're sons of day, sons of light. The day of the Lord is a night thing, comes like a thief. Therefore, this is the only conclusion you can draw, is that your behavior ought to be characterized by these three things. So the conclusion that I've drawn from this use of these two things is that it's an emphatic turn to a conclusion. Paul wants the Thessalonians to know just how potent is the legitimate hope of the rapture as the believers escape from the coming day of the Lord. John had said, and we've repeated him multiple times, if you have this hope upon you, you will do this. Well, what Paul is saying is, yeah, you have this hope. You're going to be raptured. The day of the Lord's not going to have any negative impact on you. That's your hope. Given that reality, this is the way you ought to function. So it's emphatic. I think he's really zeroing in on the fact that the thesis of his letter is that if you're waiting for the Son from heaven with the proper understanding of what that means, it will sponsor what he identified in chapter 1, the work of the faith, the labor of the love, the steadfastness of the hope. And the only problematic issue in there is the relative strength of those three things. Faith, hope, and love. Or faith, love, and hope is the way he put it together. But those things have a different impact in people's lives in terms of the inevitable thing. I mean, if this is true, then this is the conclusion. That all depends on just how strong your faith, your love, your hope is. Because there are records, like in John's Gospel, where he says that there were many of the Pharisees who believed that Jesus was the Christ, but they wouldn't say anything because they didn't want to be kicked out of the religious system they were profiting so much from. And there's only two ways you can go with that. Either their faith was not legitimate. John wouldn't have said it if it wasn't legitimate, I don't think. So that only leads us to another conclusion. If you believe the right thing, but your love is fixed in the wrong direction, then you're not going to do what that faith would typically motivate you to do. So it's a relative strength of things. If your love is perfect, you'll have absolutely no fear. You'll do exactly what you ought to do. If your faith is strong enough, you will never even hesitate. You'll just insist that this is what it's going to be. And that's the reason why we struggle with a lot of things the Bible say, because we have this in our head that if you're a Christian, then this is the way you ought to be. Well, yeah, ideally. 1 Thessalonians is the letter that says, you guys are the example to all the churches of what ought to happen when the gospel's preached. But did it happen that way all the time? No, it didn't. You can't find the example of the Thessalonians in Galatia. You can't find the example of the Thessalonians in Corinth. You can't even find some of the example of the Thessalonians in the church in Jerusalem. Well, at least you couldn't for about 16 years while they let the gospel be an unstable concept in the minds and hearts of many people, because they would never nail down exactly what the gospel was until Paul went up there and confronted them and forced the issue by God's divine revelation. So when we talk about, okay, this is the way it ought to be, that's exactly right. It ought to be. Whether it'll be that or not depends entirely upon how much impact this letter has on us. Because the greater the impact that the hope we have settles into us, the more we will function like we ought to. So, in the letter, the thesis is the Son is coming back from heaven. And that's supposed to be our basis then for the choices we make. What choices should we be making? Well, according to verse 6, there are three. He says, we shouldn't sleep as others do. Well, there are a couple of things about that. In the first place, the word for sleep is not the word that was used back there in chapter 4 where a person is put to sleep by Jesus. And that's a different kind of sleep. That's a different word. Both of them talk about sleep in terms of the metaphor of being, you know, apparently unconscious. Even if you have an active dream life, the people that observe you while you're sleeping don't see you doing anything. So you're basically asleep. And both of the terms, being put to sleep by Jesus or this term for sleep, have that idea. But just like these conjunctions, there's a little nuance to each one of them that fits. And that's what we would expect if this is a suitable, fitting exhortation. So let's just think about it that way. In the first place, the let us not do something means this is something we're not supposed to get involved in. What is it that we're not supposed to get involved in? Well, it's something that has to do with what others get involved in, because we're not supposed to do this as others do. But the interesting thing about that, as others do, is that the translation kind of leaves it wide open. What do others do? But that word is exactly the same word that's used over here in chapter 4, verse 13, where he says, that you may not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. That's the same word. We could translate that you do not grieve as others who have no hope. In other words, we could translate chapter 5, verse 6, don't sleep as the rest do. The rest. That is, already identified group, those who are hopeless. So hopeless people do this, and people filled with hope don't. That's what he's saying. And the whole idea of using sleep as the thing that some people do and others don't, and it's based on whether you're living a hopeless life or a hope-filled life, that whole idea there is rooted in the issue of this nuance of sleeping. As I've already said, it's not the same word where Jesus puts people who are his children to sleep, meaning physically their body stops and he takes their souls to heaven with him and the body's put in the grave to await the resurrection. That's the issue of the sleep. Well, this verb in verse 6 is used in the New Testament with a couple of, well, actually there's, I got a whole bunch of stuff here, but it's used 20 times, okay? In the context of those 20 uses, invariably, the people that are asleep are oblivious to something that's actually going on. Classic illustration of meaning is Matthew 13:25. The farmer goes out and he sows his seed in the field, and then he goes home and he goes to sleep. And while he's asleep, his enemy comes and he throws the tare seeds out there so that the wheat and the tares are sown together. And when those two plants are growing together, when they're very young, they look exactly alike. So it's very difficult to see what's happening. But as they get a little bit further into their growth, then you can begin to see a difference between wheat and tares. And you know that the tares are worthless, and they're going to rob nutrients and stuff from the wheat. So the enemy was deliberately trying to ruin the crop. And in the story, you know, the angels say, well, shall we pull up the tares? And they said, no, you'll pull up the good wheat too if you do that, because now the roots are all tangled up together, so let's just wait to harvest and then we'll settle things out. But the point is, the farmer is oblivious. He doesn't know this guy's doing this. He's completely out of touch because he's asleep. It's also the verb that Jesus used when the ruler of the synagogue went to him and said, my daughter's dying, would you come heal her? And while Jesus is coming, they send some people from the ruler's house and say, don't trouble the master any longer. She's dead. She died. And Jesus just tells him, don't be afraid, just keep on believing. And then when he walks in the house, he says, she's not dead, she's asleep. And they laugh him to scorn. You have to wonder, now, what did Jesus mean when he said, she's not dead, she's asleep, when she was dead? Well, I think he was giving us a little hint as to this idea of this sleepiness business. And one of the ideas is that if the inactivity that has been imposed by the sleep thing, or the death thing, or whatever, if that's temporary, then you can just consider it sleeping. Just like when a person lays down and goes to sleep, and the next morning he gets up. Well, you wouldn't say he died, because he wouldn't get up. But if, in fact, they died, but they were going to get right back up, then you could say, well, it's like they were sleeping. And in a very real sense, Jesus said it that way because, number one, the girl wasn't going to stay dead very long, so it was a temporary inactivity thing. But on the other hand, he wanted to give them an excuse for their unbelief when she comes walking out of that room. So that if they don't want to believe that who he is who he said he was, they can say, well, he said she was asleep, and I guess we were just wrong she was asleep, because he couldn't have possibly raised her from the dead, could he? Nah, he couldn't do that. I mean, you know, he's a fraud. So he gave them an excuse to keep on going in their unbelief if they wanted to take it. And his definition of sleep comes across as something that's basically completely inactive. So here we have two ideas. One of them is obliviousness. You don't know what's going on. You're unconscious to reality. And the other is you're totally inactive. And that total inactivity is in regard to the reality that you're oblivious to. So if you're oblivious to the reality, then you have no activity that fits into that realm. Now, that doesn't mean you're not dreaming. That doesn't even mean that you won't get up and walk in your sleep. But the whole idea is you're both oblivious to the reality that is, and you're inactive in respect to that. So those are the two big deals. And that kind of emphasizes the condition of the disciples in the storm in Matthew 8:24, that they get in this big storm and Jesus is up there in the boat and he's, you know, I mean, he is oblivious and he is inactive. And they are terrified because they're not oblivious. There's this storm that's going to kill them. They're terrified. They're going to drown. And Jesus is up there. He's obviously wasted in terms of, I mean, he's out of it. He's out. So they go and they shake him and they, don't you care we're going to die? So that's the idea of somebody who's really under. He just, either the exhaustion has put him, he's almost like a dead person. He's so exhausted, oblivious to what's going on, and completely inactive in relation to that. And then we come to Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he takes Peter, James, and John and goes a little further away from the disciples, and he says, what the translators often, they say, you should stay awake and or stay alert and pray. And Jesus comes back after they've gone to sleep, and he says, couldn't you stay awake for 1 hour? Stay awake. Pray that you enter not into temptation. And so the real issue here seems to be, let us not sleep as hopeless people do. The exhortation seems to be best understood, I think, in harmony with its actual etymology, rather than the idea of sleeping. The actual etymology of the word is don't lie down, because if you do, you'll go to sleep. That's the difference between these two verbs in chapter 4 and 5, because in chapter 4, sleeping is a passive thing. You are put to sleep. In this text, you lay down, and because you lay down, you expose yourself to the problem of being overcome with sleep. If you don't lay down, you won't go to sleep. That's the kind of idea. So Jesus, I don't think Jesus in the garden said, stay alert. I think he said, don't lay down. If you don't lay down, you can be alert, you can pray, you can do. But if you recline, you know, every one of us has had this experience. I'm going to pray here for a little while. And we're dead asleep because we're laying down. And it just overtakes us. Well, the overtaking idea is the idea of chapter 4, where you're passive. Sleep comes upon you. Jesus puts you to sleep. But in this text, he says, don't lay down. So then, let's don't lay down as those who have no hope do. Because if we lay down, we'll go to sleep. And don't let that, well, we'll get to this, but he says in verse 10 that Jesus died for us so that whether we do stay upright or we lay down and are overtaken by sleep, we're still going to live together with him. So there's some consolation in there. But the point is, the ideas seem to actually be two. One is a sense of complete unawareness of critical realities, and the other is a sense of total inactivity that's likened unto being dead. You just, and what do we call it? Being dead to the world. Those two ideas is the idea of a person who is told not to lay down, because if they lay down, they will go to sleep. And the reason you're not supposed to lay down is because you're not of the night. You're of the day. You're of the light. You're not supposed to act like people who expect to be overtaken by sleep by lying down. Just don't lie down. And the other one is that it's obviously not to be taken literally, but it is to be taken seriously. Those who are in or of the day should never lie down, so that they will be put to sleep, and those in and of the night are never awake. They're asleep all the time. They're completely oblivious. That's the reason why they say, peace and safety. And all of a sudden, the roof falls in. If they'd have known, they wouldn't have ever said that. But they didn't know. So, I really believe that's a figure of speech that has to do with the condition of the soul and its attitudes and values. It has really nothing to do with physical sleep. It has everything to do with whether your soul is fixed on your hope, so you don't live the hopeless kind of life. You live a hope-filled, expectant kind of life. And when I say that, just let me share one of my frustrations. I'm getting up to here with hearing preachers say, God can do. Well, duh. He's omnipotent. Sure, he can do. It doesn't help me for somebody to tell me, God can do this for you. I don't care if he can do it for me. What I care about is whether he will do it for me. And the difference between what he can do and what he will do often is way different. God can do anything he chooses to do, but will he? The leper in Mark 1 knew the difference. He said, if you're willing, you can heal me. He knew he could. He just didn't know if he would. Well, in a very real sense, that's the idea here of Paul actually laying out something very specific. You're going to be raptured, and the day of the Lord is not going to come upon you. Given that, you have something absolutely firm to fixate on, and if you will do that, you will never find yourself lying down to go to sleep. So don't do it. Hopeless people do it. And isn't that really true as a physiological reality? Don't hopeless people spend a lot of time sleeping? Why? Because that's how they get out of the pain of it all. Just the more they're asleep, the less they have to deal with. Well, is that really a good position to be in? The nursing home's burning down around you and you're because you don't want to deal with being old or whatever. Wouldn't it be a whole lot better to be awake and say, oh, I need to get out of my room here because the reality is I'm going to die if I don't. Well, you can just apply that across the board. People who have hope don't succumb to hopeless despair and the sleepiness that goes along with that in a metaphor. And people who are filled with hope expect God to do what he said he'd do. And in this case, there are two things he said he'd do. Number one, he's going to send his son for you. He's going to send his son from heaven for you. And he's going to do it before the day of the Lord is poured out on the rest who are hopeless. So, our conclusion about the first exhortation is, let's don't lie down to sleep as the hopeless do. We shouldn't let anything come between us and the hope so that we just deliberately put ourselves in a position to be overcome by sleep. Just don't do it. Don't lay down. You won't go to sleep. Don't lay down means don't lose sight of the hope. Keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. And then you won't even have to deal with being distracted from that by sleepiness because you're not in a posture to sleep. You're expectant. You're upright. You're hopeful. The second exhortation is, let's be alert. Well, that's the word for let's stay awake. The idea is, stay awake. There's a little bit of confusion in the translation, particularly in the Authorized Version, between this word stay awake and be sober. Let us be alert and be sober. In 1 Peter 1:3 and 4:7 and 5:8, these words are used together. We're supposed to be awake and sober because we have an adversary who walks around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. He uses exactly the same two words, but then they turn right around and translate them a different way. And I think in verse 7 of chapter 4, it's translated watch, and then it's translated be sober again in verse 8 of chapter 5. So the translators really didn't recognize that there's a nuance here going on. So the basic idea in this second exhortation is to be on your toes. Jesus used it in his garden, in the Garden of Eden, when he says, don't lie down and become oblivious to what's happening. Stay awake. So I think that the point here is that Paul is going back on his don't sleep like others do. Stay awake. What's that mean? I think he's talking about the issue of not being oblivious to the realities. Don't let oblivion overtake your hope. But the third one is being sober. And that's the word that means don't be under the influence of a wine or any other kind of alcoholic beverage. This is a typical term. It means don't be intoxicated. Be sober. But I really think that it's explained in verse 7. Those who sleep do their sleeping at night, and those who get drunk at night. So he's obviously taking off of verse 6b. Stay awake, because those who sleep do their sleeping at night. You're not of the night. And be sober, because those who get drunk in the night. So he's explaining his meaning there. But the idea of being sober and being drunk, or the contrast there, I think is he's dealing with don't lie down. That means don't put yourself in a position that you become oblivious. And that's the idea of being sober. It means don't put yourself in a position where your natural alertness is overpowered by intoxicating beverage. I mean, you can drink yourself into oblivion, but you're actually drinking yourself into a state of sleep. If you don't take the drink, you won't get into that kind of position. So I really think that that's the parallel idea here. Be alert means stay awake, and be sober means don't start acting in such a way that fits the behavior of a person who's asleep. Remember, oblivion and inactivity. Those are the two ideas of the first word. Don't lie down like others do, so that you go into oblivion and inactivity. But on the other hand, oblivion means stay awake, don't let go there, and then the drunkenness thing has to do with the way you're acting. So, don't act like that. So I really think that the point of the drunkenness is simply the point that there are certain kinds of behavior that weakens a person's ability to respond to the reality that exists around him. And that weakness is a huge liability. So don't lie down. Be sober. They drive the same point. Don't do anything that sets you up to be driven by something less than the hope. Don't make decisions that put you in an obligatory kind of setting where there's a lot of pressure on you to do something that's not right. Just don't go there. You may not be able to accomplish some things that you'd like to accomplish if you say no to that kind of thing, but you have to at some point say, is it worth it? Do I really want to achieve that, putting myself at this kind of risk? That's kind of like drinking. You put yourself at significant risk by being drunk. So we shouldn't do that. So the whole point, I think, in this text is that what Paul is doing in one verse is he's saying the same thing twice. Because we are not of the night, we are not of darkness, we are sons of light, sons of day, therefore, as a legitimate and probably an only conclusion that we can draw, is that we should not put ourselves in a position, we should not lie down so that we are put to sleep. We shouldn't do that, but instead of not doing that, we should stay awake and we should not be drunk, or we should stay sober. Being alert just means keeping your eyes open, and in light of the hope, keep your eyes open. What's that mean? Well, it means you keep your heart fixed on the hope. Jesus is coming back for you. You don't want to make any decisions that if he were to come right now, you would be ashamed before him at his coming. John says that. If we have this hope on him, we'll purify ourselves and we won't be ashamed before him at his coming. Well, so just don't be unaware, don't be oblivious to the realities that are crowding you to make decisions that will put you in a compromising situation because you're liable to go to sleep. And if you do, then some negative things will happen. And on the other hand, don't take action like a drunk does. Don't start drinking so that you end up intoxicated and can't control what you're going to do. Those are the two issues that are involved in verse 6. Now, he's going to go ahead and pick this up in verse 7, 8, 9. And we'll pick those up and go on into those more willing next time.